Support for LAist comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years of Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, with over 200 films May 1st through 10th. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Air Talk here on LAist 89.3. Austin Cross back with you. So nice to be here on this Friday. Film Week comes up next hour. Larry and the critics are going to talk about The First Omen, Monkey Man, The Beast, among other titles. I'm looking forward to that. Stick around. That's at 10. But we start this hour with 99-cent only stores and an announcement yesterday from the City of Commerce-based chain that it will close all 371 of their locations. Many of them can be found across Southern California. Sales at those stores actually start today. That news comes a month after Dollar Tree announced that it will close nearly 1,000 of its stores. So we're going to talk about what's behind it and if this is the end of an era for these dollar-type stores. Sucharita Kodali is with me. She's e-commerce analyst at Forrester Research. That's a technology research and advisory firm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sucharita, thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
And for folks listening in who frequent 99-cent stores, I want to know how a closure could affect your household budget. I'd also love to hear any memories that you have of 99-cent stores, as well as any stores that just don't exist anymore. Remember Pick and Save? Anybody? Yeah, those throwback stores. Maybe you have a memory, maybe going there with a parent. Maybe you got something really cool that you still use. I would love to hear memories, but also if you're affected by the 99-cent store closures that are going to come. If you've maybe depended on the 99-cent store in the past, but you've since changed. You've since changed your routine, especially post-pandemic. I would love to hear from you. 866-893-5722 is our number. 866-893-5722. Come on and chat with me. It's a Friday. Let's hang out. atcomments@las.com. Also a great way to reach us. Also las.com/airtalk. We do have a comment box there, but again, line open, 866-893-5722. Sucharita, a lot of these stores were riding high during the pandemic, especially when people had SNAP benefits and things like that to spend. Why are we seeing this closure or these closures happening now?
I think that there are a few issues. In the particular case of the 99-cent stores, I don't know that it's necessarily a demographic shift where people are no longer buying or interested. This was a company that was acquired by private equity several years ago. And typically what happens in private equity is that if you, once you take on a lot of debt. And I think that's really what happened to 99-cent stores, is that it wasn't necessarily a growth story. And either they may have had challenges paying their debt, or they paid it off and, you know, now they're just kind of winding down the business. So I think it's more of an ownership issue. It isn't so much that people don't like the product, because the truth is that there are a lot of people, particularly in lower income demographics, that are dependent on these stores. And when you look at stores like Dollar General, they're otherwise doing very well. There are some issues with theft and with, you know, kind of, you heard about these smash and grab situations, right? Where, you know, there are a lot of stores that felt like it was in the best interest of employees and store security to close the stores. But there are a lot of people dependent on these stores. And I think that what this is going to do is just move a lot of people to buying at Walmart or other mass merchants that have similar merchandise.
I mean, the private equity aspect of it is already one that I haven't seen really reported a lot so far. And there's a whole show's worth of conversation that can be had about the effect that private equity can have in these spaces. Should reintroduce you. Talking right now with Sucharita Kodali. She's e-commerce analyst at Forrester Research. Sucharita, these stores, before and even after the private equity purchase, they always had very small profit margins, right, on the items that they were selling. That was kind of how they made it work, right?
Well, in general, well, what you they had to find items to get to the price points they wanted, right? I mean, these are not stores carrying Louis Vuitton purses or anything
The 99 cent store.
right, yeah, maybe a not a keychain. I don't even think that. No, maybe a pencil. But yeah, so yes, you had to get to a magic price point, and that limited the brands that you do business with. It limits the type of merchandise that you can do business with. And certainly, as inflation has been incredibly prevalent in our economy, and certainly in the food at home or those consumable products have faced inflation so much, and they still have, these stores like 99 cent stores. You have a magic number that you have to hit, and you really can't. You don't have a lot of leverage to go higher than that, or the shopper is going to move to Walmart anyway. So yeah, they I think they were also squeezed by some of that inflation, and that hurt their margins, and kind of any cash they may have been throwing off was probably getting depleted.
866-893-5722 for folks listening in who've maybe depended on 99 cent stores, who you might actually feel the impact of store closures. I would love to hear what you're thinking right now. 866-893-5722 is the number. But I'd also love to just reminisce with you. It's a Friday. If there's a store from the past that you loved, that you got something really cool from, maybe it was a 99 cent store, but maybe it was, I don't know, a Mervyn's, a Bullock's, a Gimbel's, one of the old school ones. And you have some memories of it. I would love to hear you share those today at 866-893-5722. In 2008, Sucharita, 99 cent stores started raising prices above 99 cents, just ever so slightly. And I would frequent it at the time because, as a college student, your quality of life was very closely tied to 99 cent stores, or at least mine was, and my campus was very close to one. So it was a win-win. But at that time, they were facing rising fuel prices, food prices. In some ways, I almost feel like it's inevitable because even then, as they started to creep up, I found myself thinking, how long can they keep this thing going? Like, if the dollar value just doesn't get what it gets, you're going to see a real shift in the product, or the prices are just going to have to go up. It seems like 99 cent stores are just were always in a tough spot because their whole marketing thing was 99 cents only and nothing above 99 cents, right? Like, they kind of locked themselves into that promise they were making to people.
Right. And Five Below is in the same boat too, right? Because their whole thing is, all right, so we'll be $5 and below. And kind of the truth is that it's hard to meet those price points. And what you can do is you can have as much as you can at those price points, but then you are going to naturally, certain categories, certain items are going to creep more than that. And it's really just a story about value. I think some of the dollar stores now, are, it's very common to see items that are closer to the $10 price range. That it is, and I do think that a lot of the merchandising ethos at this store, at these types of stores, is look, kind of we need to, our customer needs to have as much value as possible. Our goal is to try to get things down to low prices. I don't necessarily see these as companies that are just pricing in order to get the highest margin they can. These are often businesses that are pricing just to meet whatever their historic margin paradigm has been, whether it's like 30% or whatever. And even some of that gets squeezed as the price of inputs go is growing faster than their what they would likely be able to charge people. Because at this at for items that are these everyday consumables, people know what they cost. It's not like kind of you can raise the price on eggs or milk, and you can pull one over on the shopper. Like, they absolutely know these things, and and they know that shoppers are either going to substitute away to different products or to different retailers entirely if you raise your prices too quickly.
Talking right now with Sucharita Kodali, e-commerce analyst at Forrester. 866-893-5722 is our number if you're affected by the closures or the coming closures of the 99 cents only stores. Talking about some stores that have also closed in the past, Heather in West Adams says, Payless shoes, miss them so much. I mentioned Pick and Save earlier. Naomi in Ladera Heights says, just wanted to point out Pick and Save became Big Lots and is still in business. I remember that. I just think the vibe is different, Naomi. I really do. Rob is calling us from Costa Mesa. And Rob, you just got back from a 99 cent store. Tell me about what you saw. Can you just tell me what that was like today?
Yeah, we saw the headlines this morning and went down because we've traditionally bought reading glasses from the 99 cent store because they're 99 cents. The store wasn't packed. The cashier told the customer she didn't know what was going on. She had heard the news this morning just like he had. But we were dismayed in the store mainly because so many of the items were more than 99 cents. They were not as cheap as the title of the store, and we even found a flimsy suitcase for $12.99. So that was the main shock for us, is that so many of the items are not 99 cents. They end in 99, but they're way, way more than 99 cents, so I bet.
$12. What were you there for, Rob?
Reading glasses. We bought seven pair.
Wow. How much do those go for at the stores right now?
99 cents a pop. That's why we go.
That I still think that's a good deal. That's Rob in Costa Mesa, who just got back from a 99 cent store. Kristen is calling us from Commerce. Kristen, what are your thoughts right now on news that the 99 cents only stores will close their 371 locations?
I just think it's devastating because it feels like people who are either working class or just, you know, living paycheck to paycheck have less and less resources and affordable options. Apart from the high cost of living in Los Angeles, like, there's just less places that people could get things for a relatively low price. Because 99 cent store, I think, has one up on like Dollar Tree and stuff because they sell like fresh produce and they have groceries and things like that, where other places don't. So I just want to say, like, just it's an incredible loss because there's a lot of people who rely on it. And now we're going to be have to forced to go to other grocery stores where it's really, really expensive.
Gosh, I can hear the frustration in your voice, Kristen. That's Kristen in Commerce giving us a call. Erica is in North Hollywood. Erica, tell us a little bit about your past relationship with 99 cent stores and what you're thinking right now.
Can you hear me okay?
You sound great.
Great. I'm an LAUSD teacher, and we get a lot. We have to supply a lot of our own material for our classrooms, and so many of us rely on the 99 cent store to do that affordably or as affordably as possible. I'm literally on my way to my 99 cent store, which is around the corner from me, to get tissue paper right now. So especially art supplies, but all kinds of educational materials like pens and like just all of that stuff. That's how we can sometimes do it affordably. And it's going to be, at least for me, I don't want to speak for all my other teachers, but I it's going to be a great loss for us and a loss for a place where we can get supplies cheaply.
That's Erica in North Hollywood. Erica, thank you so much for sharing that. I want to go back to Sucharita Kodali over at Forrester Research, because as we heard from our caller, Kristen Sucharita, she says it's going to be a huge loss. She sounded very upset about that situation, especially for people who counted on 99 cent stores for things like produce. Where do people go now if this is taken out of communities, if 371 once operating stores become empty storefronts? Where do people go to get the essentials that they were counting on? Or where might they go based off of maybe some of the trends? What do you think, Sucharita?
Yeah, these are enormous problems. And those callers, I feel their pain. And I think that they are raising excellent points, which is those are illustrations of how the community is dependent on those types of merchants. And now you are going to have probably food deserts in places that didn't exist before. You are going to, force teachers to be paying more out of pocket. And as it is, they pay too much out of pocket for these expenses that that the government should really be covering. So so I think that where to answer your question directly, the next best option are the mass merchants like Walmart and Target where possible. Target has its dollar section in its stores. That's really it. And you know, there are some Big Lots nearby where a shopper can go, but the truth is even Big Lots is in financial trouble, and we don't know how much longer even that brand is going to persist. But this idea, this bigger idea of food deserts is something that municipalities really need to solve. And right. It could be that they give incentives for retailers to start carrying more produce, that, you know, that's one of the big challenges with the other dollar stores like Dollar General and others, is that there are municipalities that don't want them because they don't carry, you know, produce and fresh goods. They are more likely to carry tobacco and alcohol. And those are things that municipalities should be fighting against. And, you know, not that you don't carry that stuff, but that, you know, kind of you should make the presence of these stores contingent upon the fresh foods and the ability to eat healthy, and provide those communities with the resources that that low-income people need. So I feel the acute pain. I hear it, and I don't know that there's an easy solution other than, you know, kind of to get local governments involved and to try to create the incentives to, you know, kind of just have somebody be the viable substitute for this new loss.
Alberto's calling us from East LA. Alberto, what are you thinking this morning?
Well, you know what? Hi, good morning. It's going to be super, super hard. It's going to be like a catastrophe in our low-income communities like East Los Angeles, South Los Angeles, where people depend on the 99-cent store. Because of low income, you know, it's by doing that, you know, the government has to do something about it to, replace same prices and a different situation that low income people could still go and get them. I understand in middle class, you know, they could be more of a, you know, they have the economic financial to buy at a higher rate, but the people who buy it through EBT, in low-income communities, it's going to make a catastrophe. You know, I think Mayor Bass should do something about it. And from you guys in PR, you know, get involved on spreading the word and helping the communities, because, you know, people depend a lot on low. Seniors and people in low communities depend a lot on the 99-cent stores.
Alberto, thank you so much for calling us and sharing. Imelda emailed us and pointed out that the cost of bread at Target, she says, about $7, but at 99-cent stores, it was about $1.99. I also want to point out a comment from Jamie in Atwater Village, who says that the 99-cent store in Echo Park is going to be a great loss because the people have already been squeezed out of the neighborhood due to gentrification. The closest grocery stores in the area are Sprouts, Erewhon, Whole Foods, super expensive stores. I barely frequent those even. But then Jamie also says sad news for Echo Park. Suchirita, we've got to wrap up in just a second. But you mentioned Dollar General. They still are operating about 20,000 stores in the country. Now, of course, there are certain wage pressures also that we see in California that make it harder to operate a store like that. Is it the end of an era for stores like these, really low bargain stores in Southern California, or at least chains of them?
I think for now, yes, but it is such an attractive, you know, kind of size of the market. There are millions of people and there's billions of dollars at stake. So I do believe that there will be some entrepreneurs who figure out some new way to crack this market. It may not be in the next 3 years, but I think within the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see innovation in food, we'll see innovation in clothing, in all sorts of categories to, you know, kind of enable, you know, kind of low prices and good value for to serve these target demographics.
That's Sucharita Kodali, e-commerce analyst at Forrester Research. That's a technology research and advisory firm based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I also want to thank all of our listeners who called in and shared what a loss it will be for them to lose the 99 cents only stores in their communities. I truly appreciate you giving a voice to this news story, to being the voices of people who are affected by them. I really appreciate that. This is Air Talk on a Friday. I'm Austin Cross. We're on air. I should also mention, we're live streaming on Instagram right now, LAIST Official. You can see inside the studio. You can also join the conversation there. Instagram, LAIST Official. When we come back, cohabitation 101 and a question about what you wish you knew before moving in with a partner. Stick around.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Air Talk here on LAIST 89.3 on air and live streaming on Instagram at LAIST Official, where you can join the conversation, see inside the studio. And by the way, you're going to want to, a little bit later, we're going to have some empanadas ahead of National Empanada Day. I don't know who comes up with these, but ahead of National Empanada Day, which is on Monday. But we were thinking, what can we eat? What can we do on Friday? We said, of course, empanadas. We got to. So we have some incredible ones coming up from the fine folks at World Empanadas. You'll definitely want to tune in to our Instagram Live for that so you can see them. And of course, you can hear the nice, satisfying crunch sound right here. But right now we're going to talk about moving in with your significant other, because in LA it's pricey. It almost seems like a no-brainer. You like them, they like you. Why not just sign a lease together? Plus, you get snuggles. Sounds great, right? But yeah, there's a but. This is public radio. There's always a but in public radio. Research suggests that it pays to be very intentional about that decision. So next few minutes, we're going to dig into the things that you should think about, talk about before you decide whose couch to get rid of. And I want to hear from you on this because I know you have some thoughts. What did you learn about your partner after moving in together? So that's question one. What did you learn about them? Maybe that they don't do the dishes quite so often. Maybe that you're more bothered by dishes out than you thought. Maybe it taps into some deep childhood trauma. Who knows? Also, what do you wish you knew before moving in with a partner? Not all of these situations work out, as we're going to talk about, but maybe there's one in the past where you were like, gosh, if I had just seen that red flag, if I had just really thought about the way that they managed money or their credit card debt or something like that. I would love to hear what you wish you knew about your partner, what you wish you asked before moving in together. 866-893-5722 is our number. Come on, hang out. It's a Friday. 866-893-5722. ATcomments at LAIST.com is our email address. There's also LAIST.com/airtalk where you can do the comment box thingy. There's LAIST Official on Instagram. There's so many ways to reach out. If you have thoughts, don't hold back. But also, 866-893-5722. Call me. Joining me to talk cohabitation, Galena Rhodes, clinical psychologist and research professor at the University of Denver. Welcome to you, Galena Rhodes.
Hi there. I'm glad to be with you.
Also with us is Christina S. Brown, chair and professor in the Couple and Family Therapy Department at Adler University in Chicago. Christina, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Professor Rhodes, I want to start with you and the big question of how moving in happens. And I never really thought about this because when I was in my 20s and I watched it happen, I couldn't label it. But there's actually some terms that help us now know what kind of situation we're looking at. There's the sliding in versus deciding when it comes to two people who end up cohabitating. Can you just tell us the difference, start off, between sliding versus deciding?
I'd love to. So when we ask people, how did you start living together? You know what the most common answer is? People typically say, it just sort of happened. They describe it as something they slid into rather than making a decision about. And one of the reasons that's important is that we find that living together can cause some new stress for couples. And it also increases the chances that you're going to stay together and even marry this person later on. And so the way I think about that is, you know, making a decision typically gives us better outcomes rather than sliding into something that might get us stuck in a circumstance we didn't really intend to be in.
I know, I totally understand how the sliding happens. So 866-893-5722, just re-upping our number. If there's something that you've learned about your partner since you moved in together, something that you've learned about yourself since you and your partner moved in together, or something that you wish you knew before moving in with a partner, 866-893-5722, atcomments@las.com. Professor Rhodes, you mentioned these chances of success. There is research that shows that people who move in together before at least getting engaged are more likely to be maybe dissatisfied in marriage, more likely to divorce. Any sense as to why that is?
Yeah, so we now know from decades of research and a study of ours that we conducted on people who were married between 2010 and 2019 show this too, that for people who moved in together before they were engaged, before they had decided that they were going to get married, tend to have worse outcomes in marriage. They're less happy and they're more likely to get a divorce. Mm. And the way we think about that is that it is related to sliding versus deciding, that there are some people who move in together who then go on to stay in the relationship and get married who may not have gotten married if they hadn't moved in together beforehand, because there are a lot of kind of external commitments that start to build up once you move in together. You know, if you sign a lease, you're now at least committed for the next year to this person, right? You share friends, you're more likely to get pregnant. You rely on one another financially. There are a lot of what we consider constraints and things that make it harder to end a relationship.
Wow. Talking right now with Professor Galena Rhodes, clinical psychologist and research professor at the University of Denver. Let's go to Christina Brown, chair and professor in the Couple and Family Therapy Department at Adler University in Chicago. Professor Brown, it seems like there's a lot of need in this situation then for couples to be very clear about their expectations, maybe make some clear plans, have a clear reason why they're cohabitating. It seems already now that sliding is the worst way, deciding might be the best way. Top of your head, what are some of the starter questions that the partners should be having with each other?
Great question. So, you know, we definitely are encouraging partners to have conversations about what their expectations are going to be in terms of what their relationship is going to look like after they move in together. And ideally, of course, we always want them to do this before they move in together. But as we just talked about, some slide into it. So it's never too late to talk about these things. But we definitely want them to be having communications about expectations and then to negotiate different things in their relationship, including household roles, chores and responsibilities, their, you know, how their professional identity impacts their personal identity, family of origin. We have a whole great list of different questions for couples to explore.
I mean, can I ask, and it kind of, this is a question that rose within me as I did the research for this conversation, but it seems like maybe a cool move for people who are engaged. Obviously, pretty cool move for people who are married. But it also seems like there's just so many different ways that things could go wrong, or you could end up just kind of sliding into a life that isn't really the one that you wanted. Do you see actual advantages in couples cohabitating, at least before engagement?
So, you know, I'm of the stance that I do think it's helpful.
You do.
I think it's an opportunity to explore sort of any of those things that might blow up a relationship later on. But I also think it's a really personal decision that's steeped in, you know, family of origin issues, faith beliefs, economics. There's lots of things that contribute to that decision. But if that's where the relationship is at, we can definitely help them explore things to continue to make their relationship grow.
866-893-5722. Question is, what did you learn about your partner when you moved in together? What did you learn about yourself when you moved in together? And maybe what do you wish you knew about your partner? What you wish you asked before deciding to cohabitate? 866-893-5722 is the number. atcomments@laist.com is our email address. There's also laist.com/airtalk. We're also live streaming right now on Instagram at laist. Official. So many ways to reach out. Rose is calling us from Santa Monica. Rose, what did you learn when you and your fiance moved in together?
Hi. Well, he's my now fiance. So when we moved in together, we had just been dating and knew each other for a couple of years. And I just had to call in because I thought it was so funny that you tied, you know, leaving the dishes out to childhood trauma, because that's just not that really did happen to us. You know, he grew up in a household that was very clean. I grew up in a household that was also very clean and kind of strict, but I handled it in the completely opposite way of, like, when I moved out and I was on my own. You know, I'm not a pack rat or anything like that. But I definitely took back that independence. And if I want to leave my dishes in the sink overnight, I do. Whereas he does not like that. And that was a friction that I was not expecting when we moved in together. And I do agree. I think moving in together, though, before we got engaged has been incredibly useful and only strengthened our relationship, if anything. But it does bring up childhood trauma that I otherwise would never have expected, particularly just tied to doing the dishes and leaving the dishes in the sink. It seems so silly, but it's so fascinating how you brought that up. I didn't realize that other people might way.
Rose,
honestly.
Rose, if there's one thing I've learned after being married is that we're all the same. We're all having the same problems. Just different ways of talking about him, but they were all going through the same thing. That's Rose in Santa Monica. And I'll actually mention on a personal level, so my wife and I did not live together before we got married. And so obviously there were, I wouldn't even call them surprises, there were things that we learned about each other by being in close proximity. And something that becomes very apparent to a person, especially if you've lived on your own, maybe with or without a roommate, and then you're moving in with a person, is you realize that you've maybe started to build your life around your preferences and your likes. Maybe you have a favorite soap, you know, maybe you do have a dishes routine where you do the dishes in the morning when you wake up, and really realizing the differences between how people approach things. For what I learned personally about myself, I will say also is that I learned, for example, when my wife does cleaning, she might put something out for a little while, or it might stay out for a couple hours, or it might stay out for a couple days as she organizes things. And she is incredible at organizing things. But I didn't realize how much I'm bothered by clutter sometimes. But then I learned that I also clutter. So then you learn things about yourself, too. I realized, to quote Taylor Swift, that I'm the problem. It's me. As well. 866-893-5722 is our number, by the way. If you'd like to call in, tell me what you learned about your partner after you moved in together, what you've learned about yourself, what you wish you knew. 866-893-5722. I want to go back to Professor Rhodes at the University of Denver. When it comes to splitting up things like bills, this could be a really contentious one, especially in LA. You're trying to determine where you want to live. Obviously, rents are going to vary. If one person wants to live in Echo Park, or if a person wants to live in, I don't know, Covina, you know, there's very big differences in what you can expect to pay. How do people navigate these conversations, especially when it's possible that one partner, you know, could be pulling in six figures, the other partner could be, you know, barely cracking $50,000, $60,000, and that can make a whole lot of difference for people.
Yeah, you know, what we find in talking to people who are living together or who lived together before they were married is they often don't talk about those details as they're moving in together. And what I think can be hard is that when you're living together, a couple is often both addressing some of the issues that dating couples are typically working on together, things like how much time they spend together, the future of the relationship and their commitment, time with friends, meeting family. And they're also managing issues like this around how they share finances, who pays for how much of the rent, all of those kinds of issues, household chores, leaving the dishes out, that people who are married tend to address together. And so it can be a time where there can be a lot of conflict and a lot of things to work out, and most couples don't go into living together with a clear plan for how to do that.
And I'll also say, because I've seen people make this mistake before, there's also a lot of people advising that when they do move in together, they move into a new place, right? You don't just move into somebody else's place. There seems to be a real advantage to that, right?
I think so, in that it increases the chances that you're having these kinds of conversations and communication about what living together will be like. You're sorting out how you're going to manage the rent and household contributions, but you're also likely really thinking about moving in together as a relationship transition and experience, that it is, you know, you're recognizing the commitment that you're making to one another if you're moving into a new place, because you're probably having to have some more of those conversations about what living together means to each of you personally and to your relationship and what you think about the future of your relationship.
I want to go back to Christina Brown, because there's all these things that we've talked about. There's kind of choosing that neutral ground, like getting a new place, like we just talked about. There's conversations about money. There's obviously splitting the bills, conversations about expectations ahead of time. And then there's the exit plan. Is it important for people to at least kind of have a parachute in these situations?
So we definitely talked about in our work on developing these questions that it is important for relationships to talk about an exit strategy at the beginning. And part of that is also to determine what are some of those things that might be, you know, pitfalls moving forward, so that they could work together ahead of time to avoid them. But I think it's also about security, that if we know, you know, what's going to happen in the future, we can be able to sort of focus on what's going on right now with our whole heart and attention, rather than always worrying about what's going to happen next.
Pat is calling us from Hollywood. Pat, tell me a little bit about your experience.
Well, my husband and I drifted into living together. But, yes, dishes in the sink, clothes on the chair. He's the king of untidy. I'm the queen of tidy. But let's put it this way. We've been married 40 years. He is a white Englishman. I'm a black American. And I think what you do is put emphasis on things in the relationship that you value. He puts up with my whatevers. I put up with his. It's called compromise. It's not even called marriage. It's called compromise.
Getting not marriage is compromise. It's Pat in Hollywood. Professor Rhodes, I got about 10 seconds left, but any thoughts on what you just heard there?
Pat, I love hearing that and recognizing that living together and being married, you know, is compromise. It is learning about these things about one another. But these are not the things that make or break a relationship or a marriage, right? It's how you deal with the differences and how you make compromises and communicate.
It's Professor Galena Rhodes, clinical psychologist, research professor at the University of Denver. We also heard from Christina Brown, chair and professor in the Couple and Family Therapy Department at Adler University in Chicago. My thanks to both of our guests for joining us. Such a fascinating conversation. Hey, it's Air Talk on a Friday. I'm Austin Cross with you as always. And we are live streaming right now on Instagram at LAIST Official. That's LAIST Official. And you might, if you can safely, you might tune in because it is Food Friday. And we're having empanadas when we come back in just 90 seconds. Stick around. We're going to chow down.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Air Talk here on LAIST 89.3, Austin Cross with you. It is Food Friday. We are on air and we are live streaming right now on Instagram at LAIST Official, where if you were to tune in, you would see half a screen of me and then half a screen of a beautiful tray of empanadas, courtesy of World Empanadas. Leah Hertz is co-owner. She also brought her husband, who's taking pictures in the green room, which I love to see. It's a family-owned business in Burbank, California. Leah, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me here.
Before we talk about the wonderful smell that is wafting toward me right now and just how beautiful these empanadas look, I want to go back to what inspired you to get into empanadas to begin with. What led you to the empanada business?
Well, I think part of it was necessity. You got to reinvent yourself sometimes. Mm.
That happens, yeah.
So I had this idea when I went to Argentina, and that's where my husband's from, Carlos. And I saw that there were empanadas everywhere in every corner. Oh. So I thought, you know, we don't have that in L.A. And so this was back in 2012. And so I decided, well, you know, we're gonna try it. And our son, our youngest son, Matthew, became a chef right around that time.
Convenient.
Right. And then we had the opportunity to have this friend of ours give us a 400 square foot back little deli that he had in back of a liquor store.
Mm.
And he didn't charge us rent for 6 months.
That's nice.
And so we began doing that, and it was great. You know, soon after we opened up, we started to have a following. Pretty soon Jimmy Kimmel's show started ordering. And so, you know, it was kind of really cool the way it happened.
I love it. That's like such an only in LA sort of experience.
Right.
So what I found was fascinating about empanadas, which, you know, put it under the list of many things we know exist, but we don't actually focus in on. But the name comes from the verb empanar, which means to wrap or coat something in
bread.
We see that show up a lot in different cultures, though, mm-hmm. right? Like things wrapped up in bread. So it's kind of like this is the Argentinian representation of it, but it's something that appears in so many places, right?
It does, and that's one of the reasons we named it World Empanadas, because we really wanted to make different fillings. Mm-hmm. From different places. You know, in Italy, you have something like a calzone, which is like an empanada.
Right.
It's just bigger. I mean, you have pierogies. You know, you have something wrapped in dough, a filling wrapped in dough in almost every country, whether it be sweet or, you know, savory. So, yeah, that's why we decided, you know, we made different fillings. And Matthew, our son, the chef, actually has made even a cricket empanada.
How did you bring any of those today?
No.
Ooh, that would be an experience. Right? I've heard they're a little nutty. I'm actually kind of curious at this point. You mentioned the different flavors. You have, 19 different kinds?
19 different
flavors. Tell me about some of the flavors, the fillings. Yes.
The fillings, I think, coming from Argentina, I found that their food was a little bland for my taste and for Southern California. So we decided to add some spice, like spicy potato, chili con carne. That was my mother's recipe. And then we made a few like quinoa and lentils, which is really good. And it's a vegan empanada. And then Matthew has made some that are, cashew cheese. That one is
cashew.
Yeah.
And cheese.
It's the cheese is made out of cashews. So it's a vegan.
Oh, wow. Somebody like my wife would love that. She's lactose intolerant. Yes. That sounds great.
Yes, and people really, really like that.
What a good option.
So, yeah, he makes bang bang chicken. He's made pepperoni and cheese, just about everything that you can put on a little, on our little round.
It's Air Talk on a Friday. I'm Austin Cross. I'm talking right now with Leah Hertz, who's co-owner of World Empanadas, because we're doing Food Friday here. If you tune into Instagram, LAist Official, you will see a beautiful tray of empanadas before me, which I will try in just a second. But I also want to point out this little guide that I have in my hands, because each side of the empanadas, it's stamped with a letter that tells you what's in it. So I'm actually going to try one right now. And I'm just going to dive in randomly. But this one says CH. What is a CH?
The CH is...
Looks like, is it chili carne?
Yes, chili carne.
It is chili carne. Mm-hmm. I kind of love the exploration part of this. Okay, now before I bite into it, is it hot? Is it spicy?
It's got a little spice.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Is it going to knock me out for the next 5 minutes?
No, no.
I got to keep flying this plane for a few more minutes, Leah.
No.
Wow, this is so fun. Talking right now with Leah Hertz, co-owner of World Empanadas. I'm about to take a bite of one, but tell me about some of the more adventurous flavors that you also have too, because I see peanut butter and jelly.
We've done peanut butter and jelly. Let's see, which other ones? Mm. He did birria.
Birria.
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
He's done.
Can I just say this is so good? I know you're listening to it off, but I'm like, I'm having an experience here. I'm having a moment.
Good, good. Leo.
This is so incredible. Really quickly, because I know I interrupted you, but somebody in the Instagram live, LAist Official, says, "Tell us about the dough." Tell us about the dough, Leah.
Oh, the dough. Well, our dough is our recipe, and we're really proud of it. And also, these are not fried. Mm-hmm. So these are all. These are all baked.
My goodness. Wow.
Is it good?
Leah, y'all.
Be honest.
Y'all did well. Whew, a little speechless here. Keep going, please.
Yeah, so the dough is vegan dough, and it's very flaky, as you can tell. It's not dry, that dry dough that you usually get. So it's flaky, and then we add our sauces, right? We have
the chimichurri, okay,
right? And then the other one is green tomatillo sauce.
Okay, I gotta try.
It's a little spicy.
Gotta try both of those.
Yeah,
and you were right about the one I just tried, the chili carne. It's a tiny bit spicy, but I like some spice. So
yeah,
I think that was wonderful, and the flakiness. Right. As you were talking about it, I was experiencing it, and the flake really That gets me. That sells me so quickly. The flake is so good. I'm going to try to choose another random one from this tray. Here, I'm going to reach in the back. And this one is a BF.
That's a beef.
A beef. Okay, great. Which one of these sauces should I dip it into?
I would do the chimi. It goes very, very well.
The chimi's the one with the little, little bit. Okay, so I'm going to dip it into that. And do you have a favorite one, Leah?
Mine is spicy potatoes.
Potatoes.
Yeah, potato and cheese.
So what am I? You know what? I was kind of curious. I got to say, offhand as I chew this, and forgive me anybody who does not enjoy mouth sounds, but at 19 different flavors, I was a little bit skeptical that you could make each one sing uniquely and stand out. but holy cow, it's just so different
yes.
from the chili carne one that I just had. Just really incredible. But please continue. So you're telling me about your favorite one. What is it that you like about that one?
Well, the potato and cheese is just, you know, I grew up with my mother making some of these recipes. The chile con carne and the potato and cheese and all of that, you know, she didn't make empanadas because we didn't make empanadas, but those are dishes that she made and then we turned them into the fillings, which, I mean, you can make anything, right?
Right.
You can make anything really, peanut butter and jelly. And, you know, it's funny because a lot of the mothers around the neighborhood, they tell me, that, you know, I solved their problem with these because they, you know, they take vegetarian for them and the husband wants meat or chicken and then the little girl won't eat anything but ham and cheese.
Right.
So she says, we just make a salad and we buy a dozen and there's dinner.
Can make the whole family happy.
That's right.
There's no need to compromise.
Right. Yeah.
I'm hearing the closed music, which means I can't enjoy another one of these, though I did just pick up a chicken one, so I'm still going to do it. You can join us on Instagram Live at LAist Official. We'll do the after hours tasting. But for those folks who are leaving us on the radio, I'm Austin Cross. This is Food Friday. We were just talking to Leah Hertz, co-owner of World Empanadas. Somebody on Instagram is asking, where can I get them? World Empanadas in Burbank. Fun for the whole family. Clearly, 19 different options. Everybody's going to find something that they like. And let me tell you, these are stellar. Thanks so much for joining me. Film Week is next. Leah, thanks so much for being on with us.
Thank you so much.
Take care, everybody.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor and Manuel Betancourt, contributing editor at Film Quarterly. First up, the horror film The First Omen, starring Nell Tiger Free. The film is directed by Arkasha Stevenson, and Arkasha is one of the writers, along with three other credited screenwriters. Manuel, what do you think of The First Omen?
I mean, as a horror cinema agnostic, this is not my genre. I was kind of entertained. You know, this is a prequel to the 1976, you know, classic about the Antichrist child. And so we are in Rome and we're following this nun who finds herself in a conspiracy, finding this conspiracy about how the church is going to create this Antichrist who we have met for decades and in various iterations. It's a fascinating entry into what appears to be now the Omenverse. And it's very fascinated with female body autonomy and agency. It's basically a Rosemary's Baby. Very gruesome, very gory. There were a lot of moments when I had to like look away. But I will say Nell Tiger-Free is fantastic, and she is the movie. It's a little silly at times, and there were a lot of groans in the audience for a couple of things, especially the final line that did make me just roll my eyes and be like, oh God, do you really have to go there? But I will say, Sonia Braga on screen is never nothing to sneeze
so
at.
So true.
And she is plays this imperious, mysterious, creepy nun, and she's great.
I'm not surprised. You know, there's Gregory Peck back in the original Omen film.
Right, right.
Yeah. The First Omen, rated R, starring Nell Tiger-Free, Arkasha Stevenson, the director, and it's in wide release. Monkey Man has Dev Patel as a triple threat. He stars in the film, directs the movie, and is one of the three screenwriters. Peter, what'd you think of the action thriller Monkey Man?
Well, Dev Patel definitely does not want to be known anymore for, you know, Kim or Slumdog Millionaire. This is basically his attempt to be the new John Wick, you know, Mumbai style. It's, you know, in pulp terms, inspired by the legend of Hanuman, which is the monkey deity, Hindu monkey deity. And we first see him in a kind of an underground fight club where he's wearing a gorilla mask. And basically, he's the bad guy in these, but they're not staged. I mean, he's really getting pulverized in all of these matches. And there's some sort of masochistic element that happens, you know. But it's a vengeance movie because when he was a kid, his single mom, he was very close to her. And then these real estate developers came into their community and the chief of police, and they wiped out the community. They murdered the mom. So he's after the chief of police, basically, who murdered his mom. And he infiltrates this sort of high class club to get to all these high rollers who were responsible. And it's extraordinarily violent, you know, even for a film like this. It's also very self-consciously in the John Wick mold. There's even a character at one point that says, you know, so do you like John Wick? there's also some Rocky stuff in here. You know, instead of Rocky pounding a side of beef, Dev Patel is, you know, training by hitting bags of rice. You know, okay. It's, for what it is, it's quite effective. And Patel is a credible action hero. You know, when you look at Keanu Reeves, you don't necessarily think of him as being, you know, some hulky action star either. And so it works, you know, in that sense. And it's well directed, again, for what it is. There's a lot of smash and grab pyrotechnics in the camera work and so forth. But for this kind of movie, it's effective.
Monkey Man is rated R. It's in wide release. The Beast is a French sci-fi romance starring Léa Seydoux as well as George Mackay. The film's written and directed by Bertrand Bonello. What do you think, Manuel, of The Beast?
This is a wild and unruly film. It's weird. There's like three timelines. We're in the future where a woman is trying to scrub her DNA so as to not feel anything and be a better worker. And so she gets to experience these two past lives that she's had, one in sort of 19th century France and the other in 2014 Los Angeles. And the movie is loosely inspired on Henry James's The Beast in the Jungle, which anyone who's read it is sort of about the lives you could have led if you had not been sort of so consumed with the dread of longing and the dread of sort of something looming on the horizon. And that kind of anxiety and that kind of looming fear infects the entire movie. It's quite long and it is very ambitious. And both Seydoux and Mackay are fantastic. I was more drawn to the more Jamesian sort of, we're in, you know, these ill-fated lovers are meeting, and I like that better than the bleak sort of LA set or even the more sort of obliquely dystopian. But there's a lot to love here and a lot to grapple with, which I just really enjoyed in that sense.
And even with part of that setting of it, the film is in French with English subtitles. Peter, what'd you think of The Beast?
Well, you know, it's a 2.5-hour movie. And I would say for the first half hour, if I didn't have a professional obligation, I might have, you know, decided to take it's very slow and convoluted. As Manuel said, it sort of shifts back and forth between three different time zones, you know, the Belle Epoque, 2014, 2044. There's a lot of, you know, highfalutin stuff about AI and you know, losing our memories and anonymity in the future and, you know, all this stuff. I don't know that it really amounts to a hill of beans. It's just sort of window dressing for what's essentially a kind of David Lynchian experiment in a way. I mean, there's a lot of Twin Peaks-ish stuff in this movie, I think consciously so. And so it got a little better for me later on there's one terrific scene where, you know, there's a doll manufacturing plant on fire, and the two of them have to escape by going into a pool and trying to swim out from underneath, which is really quite harrowing and powerful. And there's some creepy stuff in the L.A. scenes with Mackay as a kind of stalker. And, you know, they're both quite effective. Sidhu is worth seeing in anything. Mm. But I think it's, you know, a sort of fancy form version of Much Ado About Nothing.
We're talking about The Beast, the French film, which is unrated. You can see it at AMC's Burbank 16 and at the Landmark Sunset in West Hollywood. The Greatest Hits, a romantic comedy starring Lucy Boynton and Justin H. Min. It's written and directed by Ned Benson. Manuel, what did you think of The Greatest Hits?
I was so surprised by this film, because reading the logline, it sounds kind of hokey. So we're following Boynton's, and she's this woman, Harriet, who's dealing with the grief. Her boyfriend was killed in a car crash 2 years ago, and she's stuck that whenever she hears a song that she first heard with that boyfriend, she's transported back to that moment. And of course, this is a perfect metaphor for grief. Like when we lose someone, when we see something of theirs, when we have shared something, like it just brings us back. And for here, it's tangible. And she's actually time traveling. And of course, she's spending the entire movie being like, can I keep him from dying? Which is also a kind of fascinating. So it's a little bit, you know, Eternal Sunshine meets High Fidelity, because it's all about records and vinyls. And she's like trying to find the right song to get her to the right moment, all the while not dealing with, of course, the underlying grief. And I think that's where the movie really surprised me. And it really hit me. And maybe I was just in the right mood. But I just found it so charming and so grounded in this sort of like lo-fi, sci-fi, rom-com. And this is also the film that you will be able to see the upcoming Superman, David Corenswet. So if you're, you know, itching to see what that's going to look like, he has a bit part here as the boyfriend.
All right.
Long lost boyfriend.
We're talking about The Greatest Hits, written and directed by Ned Benson, starring Lucy Boynton and Justin H. Min. You can see it in a week run that's on right now at the AMC Burbank Town Center. And then next Friday, April 12th, it'll begin streaming on Hulu. The Greatest Hits is rated PG-13. The documentary Girl State follows the 2020 documentary Boys State. That film looked at boys who go to this annual gathering and run for different governmental positions within the context of the week-long event. There is a girls' version of it, and girls come from all across Missouri to be part of it. Girl State is directed by Amanda McBaines and Jesse Moss. You'll be hearing from them later on the program. We'll be talking with him about Girl State. Peter, what did you think of the documentary?
Well, it's inevitably interesting. It's about 500 girls from Missouri who are in this, I believe it's a week-long event, and sponsored by the American Legion. There's also the boys event, which for the first time in the history of these events is on the same campus at the same time, although they're fairly segregated in terms of, you know, getting together or anything like that. It's whenever you make a film like this, and I'd be curious to hear what the filmmakers say, but, you know, you have to sort of choose in advance who you're going to go after, and, you know, on the assumption that some of them are going to advance high enough so that it's worth, you know. And that's sort of the case here. There's some, you know, really fascinating examples. There's a girl, Nisha, who seems to be from India, I believe, and she is very self-conscious, but she wants to be chosen for the Supreme Court. And but, you know, she feels a little bit clueless about all of this. And so she and friends encourage her to watch the movie Legally Blonde to kind of get with the zeitgeist. There's a girl named Emily who's comes on very strong in the beginning and says that, you know, she's been the president of every club she's ever been. Like, she lives like 15 clubs in high school. She reminded me of Reese Witherspoon in Election, you know, just sort of, you know, annoyingly gung ho. And then there's another girl, Faith, who's very left wing, as opposed to Emily's professed conservatism. So there's a real mix here. What I found fascinating is that these are all basically 16-year-olds, and yet many of them profess, you know, a real about distaste for sexism, for patriarchy, for all of these things that much older women, you know, in older generations are dealing with now. But and I don't think, if you know, even 10 years ago, if you had made this movie, you would have been hearing this kind of chorus. So, I mean, I thought that was, you know, I mean, how much of their lives are affected by sexism at that age as opposed to later on? You know, are they mouthing what they're hearing from their parents and so forth, or is this something that directly affects them? To some extent, they talk about this. I wish there had been a little bit more of the informal, you know, get-togethers of them and hear what they have to say about it more informally. But it's, you know, it's a fascinating movie. There's a certain cult-like aspect to this whole process, which I found a little creepy. You know, they have to sort of sing songs and clap on cue and, you know, make cupcakes and you know, they're upset that they're not getting as much as the boys are and so forth. You know, so there was that aspect to it, which is not entirely dealt with, I think. But you know, it's a fascinating cross-section of what's going on with at least that generation in this state.
Girl State, the documentary on Apple TV Plus. Manuel.
I loved Boy State, and I felt when I watched it in 2020, like, here is a terrifying portrait of the American political system. Girl State tries to do the same thing, but of course it ends up being about how difficult it is to be a woman, and to be a woman in politics, and to be a girl, and to be a girl that's being empowered in very condescending ways, to be like this idea, like girl power. And so while the boys are discussing like actual policies, the girls are like, we're women and we all support each other. And some of them being like, the Roe v. Wade decision is about to drop. Why are we not having more intense conversations about it? And I think when those moments happen, because this does happen in the week when the decision was leaked and then when the decision was eventually passed down by the Supreme Court, it's when the sort of urgency of what's happening here and the disparity and the inequality of the Girl State program, especially compared to the Boy State program, which is happening right across campus, I think that's when the documentary really comes alive and becomes, again, an indictment of just the American system, and also, you know, misogyny and sort of the need for these programs, and also the sort of banality of them at the same time.
We're talking about the documentary Girl State from directors Amanda McBaines and Jesse Moss. We'll hear from that team coming up a little bit later. Girl State, the documentary, is streaming on Apple TV Plus. Coming up, we'll talk about the French drama Farewell, Mr. Halfman, and many more films. It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Manuel Betancourt and Peter Rayner. Up next is the French drama Farewell, Mr. Halfman, set in 1941 occupied Paris. The film stars Daniel Auteuil. The film is directed by Fred Cavaillé, who also co-wrote the screenplay. Peter, what did you think of Farewell, Mr. Halfman?
It's a very good movie. It's based on a play that's well known in France, but you don't really get the sense that this is a, you know, a stage adaptation. It's fluid without being, you know, overly conscious of being cinematic, quote unquote. It's set in occupied Paris in 1941, and Daniel Auteuil plays a Jewish jeweler, a highly respected jeweler, at a time when all of the Jews have been required to declare themselves as Jews to the authorities. And so, seeing the writing on the wall, he quickly dispatches his wife and children to the free zone in the countryside. His plan is to sell the jewelry shop to his assistant, and then when the war is over, when things improve, he'll come back and buy it back from him. But his plan to escape himself is stymied, and he ends up hiding out in the basement of the jeweler shop, with no end in sight. It's, you know, as Holocaust dramas go, I think the advantage to this film is that ultimately it's a psychological study. It's about the Daniel Auteuil character, Mr. Halfman, and this worker played by Gilles Lellouche, wonderfully played, whose wife Sarah Giraudoux is played by Sarah Giraudoux, is also a wonderful actress. You know, she's childless. They have a, you know, he dotes on her, but he's not the jeweler that Mr. Hoffman was. And when the Nazis start coming in to get jewelry for their girlfriends, you know, after a while they realize that the brooches aren't up to snuff. So Hoffman has to make the jewels in the basement, and it becomes very complicated. And there's also the added thing, which I won't get too much into, but you know, they're childless, and so how do you deal with that? With Mr. Hoffman in the basement. So it becomes a psychological study. And originally, the associate is a good guy. I mean, he's risking his life to hide Mr. Hoffman. But then things change. The calculus changes of their relationship. Things become scarier and more fraught. And it's all very well played. Daniel LaToya is a wonderful actress. He's always so versatile in all that he does. So I think it's a very good movie that doesn't belie its stage origins.
Farewell, Mr. Hoffman is the film. The French drama is unrated. You can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West L.A. and Lemley's Town Center 5 in Encino. Housekeeping for Beginners is a drama that is in Macedonian, Romani, Albanian, and French with English subtitles. It was the Queer Lion winner at the Venice Film Festival last year. It's written and directed by Goran Stolevski, and it stars Anna Maria Marinka. Manuel, what do you think of Housekeeping for Beginners?
This is a gorgeously messy and humane portrait of a found family. So Stolevski directed Of an Age, which is one of my favorite queer films of the past few years, and he returns now to his native Macedonia to offer us this portrait of Dida, a woman who never wished to be a mother, but, you know, when her girlfriend dies, she's left to care for her two daughters, including a very rowdy and very angry and very broody teenager. But Dida and her girlfriend had made of their home this kind of queer commune. So their friend Tony lived there and brought a bunch of hookups, but there's also all these like young teenagers who had found refuge there. So it's this like really messy kind of grouping who now have to sort of figure out how to move now that the central anchor couple isn't there. And it's shot so beautifully. It's so naturalistic. You almost feel like you're watching a documentary. Stolevski said that he was, you know, fascinated by this photo that someone had posted of someone who in Australia in the 70s had grown up in this kind of queer commune. And so he's just truly just following these characters, and you feel they're so lived in, and they've been so sort of carefully sketched together that I just wanted to live with them, even though there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of yelling, you know, there's a teenager who's just, you know, you're not my mother and you'll never will be, but so I'm going to go back to my Romani sort of roots, but then that comes with its own sort of struggles. I was just really bowled over by it, and I can see why I won the Queer Lion of Venice.
It sounds like a slice of life. I mean, not what we would think of as typical, but a very specific experience. And is it set back in the 70s or present day?
No, it's present day. So it's present day Macedonia. And I think that's what gives it a sense of like, of course, these were two women who couldn't openly live together as a couple. So when one of them dies, everyone approaches Dida and was like, oh, I heard your cousin died. And she has to be like, yes, that is who died, because that is what we presented to the world. So there, it's this... It's always hard to figure out where it was going, because you do feel like you're just witnessing. And Stolevski has such a deft hand with actors, especially younger actors, that it's just masterful here.
It sounds great. Goran Stolevski's film, Housekeeping for Beginners, it's rated R. You can see it at AMC Century City and at The Grove in Mid-City, Los Angeles. Scoop, a biographical drama starring Rufus Sewell and Keeley Hawes. The film is directed by Philip Martin, and it's written by Jeff Busettil by Peter Moffat. It's on Netflix. Peter, what did you think of Scoop?
Well, it's very crisp and effective. It's sort of in the spotlight, she said, category. You know, the Brits can do this too. Usually these movies are written by Peter Morgan, who did Nixon and Frost and every other movie.
The Queen and, yeah.
The Queen, yeah. I mean, so I guess he took a little siesta from this one. But, yeah, it's based on the... there was a famous, ultimately televised interview with Prince Andrew regarding the Jeffrey Epstein affair that aired on BBC, and the film is sort of a run-up to how that all happened. And Billy Piper plays Sam McAllister, who is the producer who overcame a lot of dissension within the BBC for, you know, doing something that some felt was sort of queasy and exploitative. And Gillian Anderson is the head, you know, interviewer for the show, ultimately with Prince Andrew, wonderfully played by Rufus Sewell. With some padding and so forth, but he looks exactly like Prince Andrew, and I imagine sounds very much like him too. It's very well done. You know, there are no nuances particularly. You obviously know where it's going. But it's effective for what it does. It doesn't quite get into, you know, what the royals thought of Prince Andrew. At one point, you know, Prince Andrew says, "Well, I'll get back to you when they ask if you'll sit for the exclusive interview." He says, "I have to ask Mummy," you know. So I would have liked to get a little bit more from, you know, Mummy's side about all this. She basically said, you know, do what you want. There's a little thing at the end where they say, you know, Prince Andrew ultimately had to step down from his duties and so forth. But I notice he's still being called Prince Andrew and he shows up at all the, royal events. So I don't know how much of a slap on the wrist that was. But it's an effective movie, and I particularly like Rufus Sewell.
I think there was a documentary that was made about that interview and how it all went sideways for the prince.
Yeah, and there's apparently another movie in the works about this as well. Yeah,
Scoop is the film we're talking about, directed by Philip Martin Manuel.
Yeah, this is perfectly fine. I don't know. It felt like the crownification of royal history. Like, there's a lot of telegraphing of what we already know, and I don't know that I found that much depth in either about Prince Andrew or the crown or like the royals or even the BBC. Like, it's like it felt kind of weightless to me. Unlike the kinds of things it's trying to be, specifically, I think Frost Nixon, which is a better version of this, but I think the Frost Nixon interview was a lot more exciting. I do wonder what it would feel like for a British audience to see this, because I'm obviously coming from it from stateside. But to me, it just, yeah, effective is a good word, because I can't think of more to say about it.
I read a couple of the British newspaper reviews of this because I was curious, like from The Guardian, and they mostly didn't like it. Okay. You know, they said, It didn't do anything for me, you know. Yeah.
Scoop is the film. It's streaming on Netflix. It's rated TV-14. Le Samurai was released in 1967, starring Alain Delon. The film directed by Jean-Pierre Melville, who co-wrote it. Peter, share with us about the 4K re-release of this film.
Yeah, it's a classic. Jean-Pierre Melville was actually a precursor of the new wave. He appears in Breathless as a sort of elder statesman, and directed all sorts of terrific crime movies and also some other types of films. He did a great Cocteau adaptation, Les Parents Terribles. This is one of his best. It's Alain Delon is a hitman, and he goes through all the usual conniptions that hitmen go through, you know, in getting pursued and pursuing. It's beautifully shot. It's Delon, at the time, Delon was considered, you know, the best looking man in movies. And I think to some extent he's sort of self-conscious about this because he has like a poker face for the entire film. He just doesn't move a muscle, you know, and Nathalie Delon, who was his wife at the time, is also in it. I mean, it's got a great cast, you know, but Melville's real name was Jean-Pierre Grombach. And he changed it to Melville in honor of Herman Melville, although I can't think of a writer who has less to do with what Melville is doing as a director. But it's definitely worth seeing. You know, I think it really holds up.
Le Samurai from 1967, getting a brand new 4K re-release. The unrated film in French with English subtitles is at Lemley's Royal in West Los Angeles and Lemley's Glendale. Musica is a film that stars Rudy Mancuso, who directed the movie as well and co-wrote it with Dan Lagana. Manuel, what did you think of Musica?
I think Musica will be, it's a great calling card for Mancuso, who stars, writes, directs, co-wrote, wrote the music for it. He got his start in doing vines and doing a lot of like puppetry, and you can sort of feel this sort of sketch-like comedy and vibe and sort of short spurts throughout the movie, which is sort of, as he says, it's based on a true story, unfortunately, because it's based on his own, about how he came to, you know, it's very well-worn kind of tale of like an immigrant child torn between what his Brazilian mother wants him to do and then what he really wants to do, which is pursue puppetry, which I think a lot of mothers, not just Brazilian ones,
would. Yeah, I was going to say, that's not national specific concern.
And then, of course, he's torn between this like Anglo white girl that he's been dating for a while and then this like Brazilian American girl played by Camila Mendes of Riverdale fame. It's all a little schematic, and I think you know exactly where the movie is going. He has a lot of directorial flourishes, and you can see him just trying to do everything. He does puppetry, and he does music, and then there's lyrics on screen, and then there's choreographed dancing, and it's colorful, and it's in Newark. And I just wanted the movie sometimes to slow down and to really give me more character or give me more characterization. He gets shot at one point, and then like that sort of never gets talked about it again. And there's a lot of that. There's more interest in the visuals and really cool sort of on-camera tricks and really fun puppetry than anything else. But it's enjoyable and amiable, if very slight.
We're talking about the film Musica, as Manuel sang, set in Newark, New Jersey. Rudy Mancuso is the star, the director, and the co-screenwriter. It's rated PG-13, and you can see it on Amazon Prime Video. It's out now. Kim's Video, a documentary about a New York City video store. It's a tribute to that location. Peter?
This is, if you were in New York at all in the 80s or the 90s, the mecca was Kim's Video, which was a video store, mostly VHS, owned by a Korean gentleman who lived in, I believe, New Jersey, young man Kim, who had 55,000 titles. A lot of them bootlegged. They was constantly being raided, and so ultimately, with DVDs and streaming and whatnot, he decided to upload his entire holdings to, of all places, a small town in Sicily, which was supposed to curate it and have it open to all cineasts. Well, that didn't happen, and the filmmakers went to Sicily to find where the library was, and instead it's just, you know, all this unboxed stuff in bad warehouses. So they steal the stuff and bring it back. You know, it's a fascinating story. The movie is a mess. It also doesn't really tell you how they financed all of this.
What do you think, Manuel?
It is such a mess. There's a fascinating story. There's a heist. There's the mafia. There's Kim. There's so much here. And ultimately, it's a mess, and it doesn't really quite do justice to what I imagine Kim's Video and its legacy is supposed to have.
The documentary titled Kim's Video, it's directed by David Redman and Ashley Sabin. You can see it at the Alamo Draft House in downtown Los Angeles and Vidiot's in Eagle Rock. When we come back, we'll talk to the directors of the new documentary Girl State on Apple TV Plus when we come back in just 1 minute on Film Week.
Support comes from Visual Communications, presenting VC Film Fest, celebrating 40 years showcasing Asian and Native Hawaiian Pacific Islander filmmaking, featuring over 200 works ranging from narrative film, documentary films, photo exhibits, and new media. VC Film Fest honors our beloved elder cultural workers, linking them to present and emerging artists to empower communities and challenge perspectives. May 1st through 10th in Little Tokyo and in Long Beach. Info at festival.vcmedia.org.
It's Film Week on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Just a reminder, in case you missed any of the reviews from our critics, Manuel or Peter, you can hear the entire film list, all of our critics' reviews, wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to Film Week or at LAist.com. Our critics earlier in the hour reviewed a new Apple TV Plus streaming documentary, Girl State. Girl State is a follow-up to a film done by directors Amanda McBaines and Jesse Moss of a few years ago, which showed the details of what Boys State was like, where you get hundreds of boys together for a politically oriented week in which they elect their own representatives and debate various issues of public concern. Here in the new film Girl State, we get 500 civically engaged teen girls in Missouri who go through this very same process. Here we hear Emily, who's one of the girls at this week-long gathering, who shares her hobbies and extracurriculars, which led to her being chosen for Girl State.
At my school, I'm kind of known as that kid. Culture Club, Key Club, Environmental Sustainability, FCA, Student Council, Connect, Melville Media, Step Team, Lacrosse. I'm missing things. Did I say Science Club? Oh, and I started a Bible study at my school. There we go.
So if you're a Federalist, Nationalist.
Yeah.
40. That's my lucky number.
Oh my gosh, that's
the year I'm running for president.
Emily Worthmore for America 2040.
I love it.
Oh my goodness.
Thank you so much.
They asked us our freshman year to pick your top three careers, and mine says President of the United States, Broadcast Journalist, Rock Star. I think I can do all three.
Superachiever Emily, just one of the 500 girls gathered at Girl State on a college campus in Missouri, where for the first time the boys were also there, but with very, very limited interaction between the boys and the girls. With us are the directors Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss. They were with us last year on Film Week to talk about their National Geographic documentary, The Mission. They were also the directors of 2020's acclaimed film, The Emmy winning Boys State. Amanda and Jesse, great to have you back with us on Film Week.
Hey, Larry.
Hi, Larry.
So let's start with what you learned from Boys State that you wanted to incorporate into telling the story of the girls' gathering.
These programs are such interesting laboratories to explore our current political condition and our possible future through the eyes of teenagers. I think we're all asking ourselves, does democracy have a future, or are we doomed? And perhaps if anybody's going to save us, it's young people, because we've certainly screwed things up. Boys State was a really insightful prism into the divisions of our country, but also the opportunities. And we wanted to flip the script and tell the story of young women. We have two teenage daughters. We think about girlhood a lot in this moment. And so we went to Missouri. We left Texas, where we shot Boys State. We went to a new state and found a new group of kids, similar experiment, very different time, very different results.
Speaking of the time, quite fortuitous because we had the leak of the Dobbs decision of the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, but it hadn't yet been confirmed that the court was going to do that. You were in that interim period. How did that affect what the girls were talking about and the tenor of this time of Girl State?
It was a moment, and it definitely colored the thinking of all the girls headed to the session that year. It's still something they think about in Missouri, because Missouri was a trigger law state, and so effectively abortion is now illegal. I think that one of the reasons we were especially interested in Girl State is they did build the third branch of government, a Supreme Court. And so there's a whole court system that the girls build, and at the top of which sits the Supreme Court, which would then be all female. And that was an interesting way to sort of watch them have this conversation and for a brief moment own the conversation, if only for a fleeting moment.
The court hears an abortion case. They hear one case in the week-long session. We were praying it would be a relevant political case, and it does happen to be about privacy and abortion. So very relevant and really powerful to see girls totally own a conversation, which I think for far too long has been dominated by men.
Let's listen to a montage of girls making their case to be on the Girl State Supreme Court.
I want to be on a Supreme Court because they make the decisions that like really affect people's lives. We're seeing that now with like abortion, gay rights, housing, the amount of money spent on a federal campaign.
My parents are immigrants, so there's always been headlines or news and policies affecting our status in the country or political beliefs.
I would love to judge
anything with environmental law. We need to make a change now before it goes to future generations.
I honestly like to listen rather than express my own views. I try not to be prejudiced.
I'm impartial.
My parents are divorced, so they like, I have to like mediate between the two. Like if they, if there's a problem, I kind of have to be in the middle.
Those are girls who are going through the process of making their case for being on the Girl State Supreme Court. We're talking with the directors of the Apple TV Plus streaming documentary Girl State, Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss. You know, one of the things I recall in Boys State is there was some pretty robust political debate across partisan and ideological lines. Here, Emily, the girl that we heard first detailing all the things that she did, all the activities, she expresses some concerns about being conservative and how she's going to be received. Her perception is that this may be a majority liberal group of girls that are part of Girl State. And I'm just wondering, did you see a difference in terms of the ideological composition versus the boys?
What's interesting, and I mentioned the script being flipped here, in Texas, we had a very conservative group, and we watched a young man who's progressive and a person of color navigate this predominantly white space and conservative space. And here in Missouri, we actually have a group of girls who are, for a red state that Missouri is, they're actually quite progressive, but Emily is conservative and Christian, and yet very much looking forward to connecting with girls who are not like her, trying to determine if she can run a winning campaign for governor in this fragile state with very different politics than hers. And I think that the challenge she faces is to be true to herself, but also connect with them and find common ground. That's really the proposition of the program. And I think it's the proposition of our country. Is there any room left for civil discourse and common ground? And Emily's journey, I think, is the central storyline in our film. And she's unexpected. I think for us, we're progressive. You know, we're from San Francisco. Our politics are very different than Emily's. And I think we're asking ourselves and our audience, can you find something you connect with this kid? And I think her journey really rewards our patience, our faith, because she has a very surprising path through this intense week.
We're talking with the co-directors of the documentary Girl State. That's Jesse Moss, from whom you just heard, and Amanda McBain. They collaborate on their documentaries. Here we have a member of Girl State talking about the importance of open dialogue throughout this process.
I'm excited. You know, I live in St. Louis. It's kind of the liberalist you get in Missouri. So I knew if I ran for governor, like through campaigning, I would be forced to like go out and talk to new people. That's why I came here. I wanted to meet like girls on the other side of the aisle. I think boys feel like they can speak louder about politics because I think women, often when we start talking politics, we get shut down. I think we're just less respected. So, you know, by the time we're 17, we're already socialized to stop talking about it.
And I just wonder, Amanda and Jesse, do you feel like that that there was an ability over time to get into some of those deeper political conversations that at first might not have been there?
There was. It took some time to get there. It took some time for the training wheels to come off the bike, which is one of the reasons Girl State felt different filming it and is a different program than Boys State, where within a couple hours, the boys are segregated into two parties and they immediately have this tribal face off and it just, things get going very quickly. With Girl State, it took a couple days. And I think at some point, the girls in our film that we're following are feeling held back. They're very ambitious, they're very smart, they're politically passionate and wanted to talk politics. They wanted to get into those meat and potato issues, but there was something holding them back, and some of that was internal, but a lot of it was programmatic, which is, you know, I think reflective partly of a system that's bigger than Girl State.
We'll continue our conversation with Amanda McBain and Jesse Moss, the directors of Girl State, streaming now on Apple TV+. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Yeah.
It's Film Week on LA's 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. In case you tuned in and missed the reviews of our critics, Manuel Betancourt and Peter Rayner, that were earlier in the program, some movies they really loved, and some under-the-radar gems that I'm sure you want to hear about, it's not too late. You can listen to the Film Week podcast wherever you get your podcast. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any one of the weekly editions of the program. It's also available for you to listen at LAist.com/filmweek. We're talking right now with the directors of one of the films that was reviewed by our critics. It's the documentary Girl State, a follow-up to Amanda McBain's and Jesse Moss's documentary of 2020, Boys State, which took us to the American Legion-sponsored boys' political activity. There it was in the state of Texas. Now it's girls in Missouri getting together, 500 of them, on a college campus for this week-long event. Jesse Moss and Amanda McBain's with us to talk about the film. How did you determine which of the girls you were going to follow? I mean, they're all well-spoken. They're all interesting personalities. It seemed like it was unlikely you'd make a bad choice. But how did you decide who you were going to follow?
It's a pretty intensive casting process, about 4 months to meet hundreds of young women across the state of Missouri. I even went to prom as part of that journey, which was a trip. conversations, more than a kind of checklist or criteria, and looking for, as Amanda said, girls who are really confident, politically ambitious, but also vulnerable. And that's a kind of contradiction to these young women really were brave to let us in. And that's not everybody who can do that, to share this kind of intense experience with a camera crew, and be vulnerable. And I think they have a kind of winning formula, a kind of magic that is the combination of those qualities. So we've picked 7 girls. They represent the full diversity of Missouri, and I think our country, conservative, left, right, women of color, women who want to be on the Supreme Court, women who want to run for governor and be president, like we heard from Emily. And, you know, then we just, when once we find them, we just hold on tight, because the week moves so fast, so furious. We have a big crew to try to capture every moment, big and small. But it's exhilarating because it's unscripted filmmaking. And this intense week really forges transformation. I think I mentioned with Emily, she really changes. You come to know yourself in profound ways when you're forced into a difficult process. And I think through defeat too, the film is about victory, but also what you do when you lose or don't get what you're striving for. And I think we, for everybody coming to the film, you can find a character in this story that you identify with and might challenge you. And I think we like that. We asked our 14-year-old daughter, you know, who's your favorite character? And she said, Faith is really, you know, really politically sharp. Not who I would have expected her to pick, but I like that.
I mean, another part of the process of casting in these conversations, by the way, all kids are interesting to me. That's just who I am. But there was a quality to the girls that we ended up going with, partly because they made me laugh. I mean, that, or they surprised me. It was one or the other. And that is key, I think, to my process, our process, actually, also.
Was it easier to convince the organizers of Girl State in Missouri to do this than it had been with the Texas organizers of Boys State, because you had this acclaimed documentary that, you know, showed the work you could do in this environment to the Missouri organizers? Was there any skepticism on their part?
It was a conversation. I'd say it really did help to have Boys State to show as a model and to show the success of the film and the conversation that ensued and how interesting the kids were. I think I have to credit the organization for trusting us, because the film does take a hard look at the program, its strengths, but also its weaknesses. It is underfunded compared to the boys program. There is a lot of fluff. That's the word the girls use. And I think these programs, like our country, are sort of straddling the 50s and the future in uneasy ways. And it's hard to change for institutions. And the program is trying to change. It would like to have parity with the Boys State program. And the girls actually are themselves the ones who have this conversation in the film, which was a revelation. We didn't expect to compare the programs. We thought they would really stand apart. But because Boys State's happening on the same campus at the same time, the girls start to look over there and say, look, wait, the boys are doing things differently. They don't have the same rules we have. They get to do things differently. They're talking politics on day one and we're not. And so I think it becomes a really resonant conversation about the structures that do account for why women are underrepresented in positions of political power in this country.
One of the things that's interesting is with the boys, they keep them, it seems like, running all the time. They're just, they're overscheduled, like, you know, as a way to deal with their energy, keep them from getting into trouble. And then with the girls, it's, I sensed a kind of a caution because there were some girls who got overwhelmed, and you could see that, you know, there was anxiety, there was stress from it. And I was wondering your thoughts, because you were immersed in both of them. Were there differences in the pacing that you think were connected to gender or just to the tradition of how each one is operated?
I think the answer is both. There is sort of a, as you mentioned, the 1950s kind of decorum expectation or lowered expectation about women being socialized to be polite and let's not upset one another and that kind of thing. And politics, you know, has some upsetting moments when you get into those discussions, and awkwardness and uncomfortability. And I think for all of those reasons, that's exactly why we should be having those conversations, because they're uncomfortable. That's the promise of these spaces in Girl State and Boy State. That's so special, bringing together people of different politics to talk to each other face to face, particularly now in our very, 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 very divided country. So the infantilization piece, though, was something that was the surprise to me. The sort of the cupcake making and the icebreakers and the use a crayon to make your governor signs and that stuff felt to me like it was borderline insulting. And in fact, I think that's how the girls took it. And I don't think that was the intention, but that was the result. And that's the pushback, I think, for these very smart, you know, debate champions and the presidents of their high schools to be in that sort of awkward position of not being able to talk about, for instance, the issue of abortion a week after this leaked opinion came out. About Dobbs, like, I think that tension was just too much. It was paradoxical.
Well, and as you're saying, you know, these are girls that have been debating with boys and have been in student government with boys and had all these other, you know, interactions. So do you think with the release of this film that the organizers of Girl State, and it's not to say every state is the same, this is a particular state run, you know, the Missouri one, do you think they might revisit how they do things?
I think they very much are. I think as a result of the conversation that the girls are forcing, and hopefully the film helps, they are sharing more resources, integrating more programs. I think programs around the country are beginning to combine the programs entirely to make people state. And while we value that the gender separated spaces for us as filmmakers to look at boyhood and girlhood, I think we're very curious about how politics works for 17-year-olds in a people state. And whether we make that third film or not, I'm not sure, but we're left with still with questions.
Well, you'd have to do it if it exists. You've already done Boys and Girls State. You'd have to do People State. No question. Amanda McBain's, Jesse Moss, thank you both for being with us on Film Week and talking about Girls State, which is on Apple TV Plus, streaming and available at home. Thank you for being with us.
Always great, Larry. Thank you.
Larry.
Thanks so much. Girl State, the follow-up to their critically acclaimed Emmy-winning documentary, Boys State of 2020. Also, their terrific National Geographic film, The Mission, which came out last year. For all of us at Film Week, have a wonderful weekend.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.